This CLE is based on the summaries of selected cases released by our New York State appellate courts in April 2019 that address issues related to criminal law. The summaries that were posted on the website in April have been compiled in an update pamphlet, and it is that pamphlet which constitutes the written materials for this CLE course. The pamphlet is available on the New York Digest, Appellate Digest website. Turning to the update pamphlet, the first case we're going to look at is on pages 6 and 7. It's the People versus Wassell case. It has to do with the Attorney General's authority to prosecute a criminal case in New York State. The Fourth Department reversed defendants' weapons possession and sale convictions because the state attorney general did not have the authority to prosecute the case. The attorney general's authority to prosecute a criminal case is triggered when a request is made by the head of an appropriate agency, here the superintendent of the state police. No such request was in the stipulated record on appeal. The court wrote, Executive Law, Section 63, Subdivision 3, grants the attorney general prosecutorial authority upon request of the head of any department, authority, division, or agency of the state. Although the people assert that the attorney general had authority to prosecute this matter under Section 63, Subdivision 3, based on a request made by the state police, such request would confer that authority only if made by the head of the division, that is, the superintendent of the state police. The state bears the burden of showing that the division or agency head has asked for the prosecutorial participation of the Attorney General's office, and again, the record on appeal did not include such a request. Next is People v. Stewart on pages 7 and 8. It has to do with a speedy trial motion and ineffective assistance of counsel. The First Department held that defense counsel was ineffective when he filed a speedy trial motion 10 days before the speedy trial clock would have run out, and the indictment was dismissed in this CPL 440.10 proceeding. The court said, The CPL 440.10 hearing record establishes that counsel had no strategic reason for filing the speedy trial motion in the form and at the time he did, and that his handling of the motion was objectively unreasonable. The prejudice prong of a single error ineffectiveness claim was satisfied because it is well settled that a failure of counsel to assert a meritorious speedy trial claim is, by itself, a sufficiently egregious error to render a defendant's representation ineffective. Next is People v. Clark on page 8. It has to do with the warrant requirement for obtaining cell site location data. The Second Department held that the court order authorizing access to defendants' historical cell site location data in this murder case was the equivalent of a warrant because it included an express finding of probable cause. The court said, The court order authorizing the acquisition of the records made an express finding of probable cause, which was supported by the people's evidentiary showing. Accordingly, the order was effectively a warrant, which would complied with the requirement of Carpenter. That's Carpenter versus United States, 138 Supreme Court 2206, a 2018 case. Next is People versus Goldman on pages 8 and 9. It has to do with the requirement that the defendant receive notice and an opportunity to be heard before the execution of a warrant for the collection of DNA evidence. The First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the defendant was entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard in opposition to a warrant application for the collection of DNA evidence. Defendant was incarcerated and represented on another matter at the time of the warrant application. The court said, In general, search warrant applications are made ex parte. However, as explained in Matter of Abe A., New York Court of Appeals case 56, New York 2nd, 288. Special rules apply to evidence to be taken from a suspect's body, such as blood or DNA samples. The hearing court excluded defense counsel based on its understanding that the discussion of notice in Abe A. applied only to the first discrete level of Fourth Amendment analysis identified in that case, involving the seizure of the person necessary to bring him into contact with government agents, and not the second level, involving the subsequent search and seizure for the evidence. Nothing in the court's opinion suggests a basis for applying the elementary tenet of due process described by the Abe court only to the first part of an application for an order to physically detain a person and then make a corporeal search. Accordingly, defendant is entitled to suppression of the DNA evidence obtained as a result of the warrant issued by the hearing court and a new trial. Next on page 10 is People v. Jones. It's a double jeopardy case involving ineffective assistance. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to vacate his conviction and set aside the sentence should have been granted. The court noted that the waiver of appeal did not apply because the alleged error affected the voluntariness of the guilty plea. At the time defendant's assault second conviction was overturned, he had completed his sentence. When he subsequently pled guilty to assault second, more prison time was imposed. That violated the prohibition against double jeopardy. Defense counsel was ineffective for not arguing defendant must be sentenced to time served. The court said, at the time of remittal, it was clear that more than 15 years earlier, defendant had been sentenced to 7 years in prison for his conviction of assault in the second degree, which was the maximum permissible sentence. It was also clear that his assault conviction had been overturned on appeal. These facts and circumstances alone would have alerted a reasonably competent attorney to the possibility that any subsequent sentence that included additional prison time might violate the constitutional prohibition against multiple punishments and, by extension, prompted an inquiry into the amount of time that defendant had already served in prison on his 2001 assault conviction. Defendant had already served the maximum permissible prison term for assault second, and therefore could be sentenced only to time served. Next is the People v. Herrera, which is on page 11. It's another case involving double jeopardy. The First Department held that prosecuting defendant for conspiracy to commit murder after a trial for the murder resulted in a conviction for manslaughter and gang assault did not violate the prohibition against double jeopardy. The court said, the applicable rule is that where the same act or transaction constitutes a violation of two distinct statutory provisions, the test to be applied to determine whether there are two offenses or only one is whether each provision requires proof of an additional fact which the other does not. That's the Blockberger test. Blockberger versus United States, 284 U.S. 299. Neither the fact that the evidence at the homicide trial would have also supported a conspiracy charge, nor the fact that defendant had been alleged to have acted in concert with other persons, has any relevance under the Blockberger test. So again, the conspiracy prosecution did not violate the double jeopardy prohibition. Next is People v. Farrington on pages 11 and 12. It deals with excited utterances. The Fourth Department held a statement made by the victim of an assault 12 to 15 minutes after the assault was admissible under the excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule. The court said, testimony at trial established that at the time of the statement, the victim appeared to be emotional, mad, angry, and very agitated. The statement qualified as an excited utterance inasmuch as that statement was made shortly after the assault and while the victim was under the extraordinary stress of his injuries. Next, People v. Smith, page 12. It's an excited utterance and present sense impression case. Second Department held that a 911 recording was properly admitted under the present sense impression and excited utterance exceptions to the hearsay rule, and defendant was properly sentenced to consecutive sentences where, intending to shoot one victim, another victim was also hit. The court said, the record established that the declarant made the call within seconds of the shooting after his son cried out that he had been shot, and the father saw his neighbor, who was also shot, and who the father thought was dying, fall to the ground in a pool of blood. Although the declarant's statements to the 911 operator were hearsay, they were nevertheless admissible under the exception for excited utterances made contemporaneously or immediately after a startling event, or present sense impressions made while he was perceiving the event as it is unfolding or immediately afterward, which are corroborated by independent evidence establishing their reliability. With respect to the shooting, which ended up hitting two persons when the defendant apparently was attempting to hit only one of them, the court wrote, the shots which hit the two victims were the result of separate and distinct acts of pulling a trigger to discharge a firearm, and repetitive discrete acts such as successive shots do not somehow merge such that they lose their individual character, where the same criminal intent inspires the whole transaction. Accordingly, the imposition of consecutive sentences for the two counts of attempted murder in the second degree was legal. Next is the Guccione case on page 13. It has to do with Freedom of Information Law request for the medical records of a victim of sexual assault, and the request was made by the perpetrator of the assault. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the medical records of the victim of sexual assault could not be disclosed to the petitioner who was convicted of the sexual assault pursuant to the Freedom of Information Law request. The medical records were protected from disclosure by the public health law, the civil rights law, and the public officers law. Next is People v. Muhammad on page 14. It deals with the consequences of a guilty plea being deportation. Second Department held that the defendant was not informed of the deportation consequences of his guilty plea, and therefore did not have the opportunity to move to withdraw his plea. Therefore, a narrow exception to the preservation requirement applies, and the matter was remitted to allow the defendant to make the motion to withdraw his plea. The court said, inasmuch as the record does not demonstrate either that Supreme Court mentioned or that defendant was otherwise aware of the possibility of deportation, the defendant had no practical ability to object to the court's statement or to otherwise tell the court, if he chose, that he would not have pleaded guilty if he had known about the possibility of deportation. Next is People v. Rodriguez on page 15. It involves a guilty plea. The defendant was attempting to withdraw his guilty plea, but the request was denied because it was deemed that he had violated his cooperation agreement. It's a Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals, affirming the denial of defendant's motion to withdraw his plea over an extensive two-judge dissent, held that defendant's refusal to testify against a person who had participated in a home invasion violated the written cooperation agreement. The court said, as part of a plea agreement and in exchange for a favorable sentence, defendant entered into a written cooperation agreement where he promised to cooperate completely and truthfully with law enforcement authorities on all matters in which his cooperation is requested, including but not limited to the prosecution of defendant's accomplices on charges related to the murder of Jose Sanchez and the assault of Sanchez's brother. Prior to entering into the cooperation agreement, defendant had confessed to his involvement in the Sanchez murder and assault, explaining that the crimes were retaliation for a prior invasion of defendant's home by Sanchez and his associates, including Jose Marin. When defendant signed the agreement, he also had testified to Marin's involvement in the home invasion before the grand jury in the Sanchez matter, and he also had assisted the police with their investigation of the home invasion by identifying Marin in a photo array. The court said, defendant's refusal to testify against Marin violated the express terms of his cooperation agreement, and again, that justified the denial of his motion to withdraw his guilty plea. Next, on page 16, is People v. McKinney. It's an identification case involving an identification by a police officer of the appearance of the defendant, or the alleged appearance of the defendant, in a videotape. The First Department, reversing the Supreme Court, held that a police officer's testimony before the grand jury identifying the defendant in two videotapes was admissible. But the court expressed no opinion whether the identification testimony would have usurped a jury's role at trial. The court said, the court erroneously dismissed an indictment charging defendant with crimes committed in two incidents, both recorded in videotapes presented to the grand jury, on the ground that a police officer who witnessed neither incident but knew defendant from the area identified him in each videotape. The detective testified from his personal knowledge. Unlike trial jurors, who can normally observe a defendant in court, grand jurors do not have that means of making a comparison between a videotape and a defendant's appearance. We express no opinion on the admissibility of a similar identification at trial. The exceptional remedy of dismissal of the indictment was not warranted. Next is People v. Calderon on pages 16 and 17. It's another case involving videotapes, identification, and police officers. The First Department determined it was harmless error to fail to sustain defense counsel's objection to the arresting officer's unprompted identification testimony that the defendant was depicted in the videotape that was being played. The court said the officer was not previously familiar with defendant, and there was no basis to conclude he was more likely to correctly identify the defendant from the videotape than was the jury. Again, it was error to allow that testimony by the police officer, but in this case, it was deemed harmless error. Next, on page 17, People v. Bynum. It has to do with what the people must prove based on what's in an indictment. Second Department noted that the people are not required to prove all of the ways the indictment alleged the crime was committed. The people need only prove one. The court said, the fact that the indictment charged the defendant with committing burglary in the third degree by both unlawfully entering and remaining in a subject premises did not require the people to prove both sets of facts, and since they proceeded only on the theory of unlawful entry, the Supreme Court properly instructed the jury on that theory only. Next is People v. Gentles on page 18. It's another case involving indictments. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court in the interest of justice, held the jury instructions in this animal cruelty case allowed a conviction on a theory that was not included in the indictment. A new trial was ordered despite defendants having served a sentence. The court said, the indictment was limited to a theory that defendant personally mistreated his dog. However, the court read Agriculture and Markets Law Section 353 to the jury almost in its entirety, including a provision that would allow the jury to convict defendant if he merely permitted another person to mistreat his dog. Unlike ordinary accessorial liability under the penal law, this theory of permitting is an entirely different way of committing the crime from personally mistreating the animal. So a new trial was ordered because the jury was allowed to consider a theory that was not included in the indictment. Next, on page 19, is People v. Wah, that's W-A-H. It's a jury instructions case dealing with the justification defense. First Department, reversing defendant's conviction over a dissent, held that the judge's jury instruction did not make it clear that finding the defendant not guilty of assault based upon the justification defense required that the jury stop deliberating. The judge had told the jury they must find the defendant not guilty on all counts if the justification defense applies, which gave the jury the impression that they had to consider each count, even if they had acquitted on the justification defense in the top count. Next, on page 20, People v. Muhammad. It's another jury instructions case. First Department, over an extensive two-justice dissent, determined one, the trial judge's giving two Allen charges and allowing the jury to continue deliberations to 5 or 6 p.m. at the jury's request on a Friday, knowing that three jurors could not continue deliberating on Monday because of travel plans, did not constitute coercing a verdict. And two, providing the jurors with both written and oral jury instructions without objection was not improper. With respect to the coercion of a verdict, the court wrote, as the record reflects, the trial court construed a note from the jury as meaning that the jurors thought that they could quickly resolve any remaining differences among them and agree upon a verdict within hours that same day, and therefore the judge permitted them to do so. There was no need for the court to address the travel plans of some jurors for the following week, because this did not appear to be a problem at the time. Next is People v. Clark on page 21. It's a juror challenge case. Fourth Department reversed defendant's conviction because four cause challenges to two jurors were denied. Neither juror gave unequivocal assurances that she could be fair and impartial. In fact, one juror expressly said she would continue to think defendant was involved based solely on his presence in the courtroom. Next is People v. Hickey. It's on page 22. It's a lesser inclusory count case. The Fourth Department dismissed the unauthorized use of a vehicle charge as a lesser inclusory concurrent count of the grand larceny charge, which was based upon car theft. Next is People v. Brooks on pages 22 and 23, obstruction of governmental administration. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's angry remark made to the probation officer, threatening to blow her up, was not a crime and therefore did not justify the revocation of probation and incarceration. The court said, although the evidence at the hearing demonstrated that the probation officer was at work, there was no evidence to show that the defendant attempted to prevent her from performing a specific function. The defendant's angry outburst, without more, was insufficient to establish obstruction of governmental administration. Therefore, the Supreme Court's finding that the defendant violated a condition of his probation by failing to lead a law-abiding life is not supported by a preponderance of the evidence. Next is People v. Tapia. On pages 23 and 24, a Court of Appeals case dealing with past recollection recorded. In this case, the police officer had testified at the grand jury, but at trial, he had no memory of the incident. The Court of Appeals, in an opinion by Judge DiFiore over an extensive three-judge dissent, held that the police officer witness's grand jury testimony was properly admitted under the past recollection recorded exception to the hearsay rule. The grand jury testimony did not violate the confrontation clause because the officer, who could not remember the incident he described to the grand jury, did in fact testify at trial. The court said, the foundational requirements for the admissibility of a past recollection recorded are, 1, the witness must have observed the matter recorded, 2, the recollection must have been fairly fresh at the time when it was recorded, 3, the witness must currently be able to testify that the record is a correct representation of his or her knowledge and recollection at the time it was made, and 4, the witness must lack sufficient present recollection of the information recorded. When such a memorandum is admitted, it is not independent evidence of the facts contained therein, but is supplementary to the testimony of the witness. With respect to the Confrontation Clause, the court said, the Confrontation Clause guarantees only an opportunity for effective cross-examination, not cross-examination that is effective in whatever way and to whatever extent the defense might wish. It is sufficient that the defendant has the opportunity to bring out such matters as the witness's bias, his lack of care or attentiveness, his poor eyesight, and even, what is often a prime objective of cross-examination, the very fact that he has a bad memory. Next is People v. McCullen on page 24. It's a sentencing case. Fourth Department held defendant's guilty plea was induced by a sentencing promise county court could not fulfill. The plea was vacated and the matter was remitted for imposition of a sentence that comports with defendant's expectations. The court said, a person is prohibited from receiving jail time credit against a subsequent sentence when such credit has already been applied to time served on a previous sentence. Inasmuch as defendant was serving a sentence on a prior conviction throughout this instant proceeding, or the instant proceedings, the court could not legally fulfill its promise to credit defendant's jail time against his sentence in this matter. Whereas here, the originally promised sentence cannot be imposed in strict compliance with the plea agreement, the sentencing court may impose another lawful sentence that comports with the defendant's legitimate expectations. Next, page 25, Sex Offender Registration Act case. The Third Department, reversing county court, held that defendant was entitled to a downward departure under the risk level guidelines. The court said, county court declined to grant a downward departure on the basis that defendant had already benefited from the victim's consent by obtaining a light criminal sentence. Clearly, this was not an appropriate factor to be considered under the guidelines. And again, the downward departure to risk level 1 was granted by the appellate court. Next, on pages 25 and 26, People v. Harrison, a speedy trial case. The Fourth Department, reversing county court, held that a period of post-readiness delay because a prosecution witness was on vacation was chargeable to the people, and defendant's speedy trial motion should have been granted. The court said, the mere fact that a necessary witness plans to go on vacation does not relieve the people of their speedy trial obligation. Next is People v. Albert on pages 26 and 7. It has to do with admissions made by the defendant to a private person who was acting as an agent of the police at the time the statements were made. The Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that the failure to provide 71030 notice of a statement made by defendant to a private citizen was a mere irregularity, not reversible error, because the statement was not involuntarily made and therefore was not subject to suppression. The court wrote, "We agree with our dissenting colleagues that the citizen in this case was acting as a police agent at the time she recorded the statements, inasmuch as she was acting at the instigation of the police to further a police objective. We respectfully disagree with our dissenting colleagues, however, on the issue whether the failure to provide the 71030 notice warrants preclusion of those statements. We conclude that it does not. Whereas here there is no colorable basis for suppression of the statement, the failure to give notice constitutes a mere irregularity not warranting preclusion. In our view, there is no colorable basis for suppression of defendant's statements to the private citizen. There's no dispute that defendant voluntarily went to the citizen's home and that he was interested in pursuing a romantic relationship with her. During the entire conversation, wherein defendant admitted committing the homicide, the private citizen made no explicit or implicit promises that she would engage in sexual relations with defendant. Rather, it was defendant who offered to tell her anything she wanted to know after she expressed that she was afraid of him, and then provided her with all of the details concerning the homicide. We conclude that the private citizen did not make any statement or engage in any conduct that created a substantial risk that defendant might falsely incriminate himself." Next, on pages 27 and 28, People v. Jackson. It's another case dealing with statements, this time with the Miranda protections. Fourth Department, reversing county court, held that defendant's statements made after he had asked for an attorney should have been suppressed. The court further disagreed with the people's argument that the error was harmless. The court said, "We agree with defendant that county court erred in denying that part of his omnibus motion seeking to suppress the statements that he made while at the police station after he unequivocally asserted his right to counsel by asking, 'May I have an attorney, please, a lawyer?' Specifically, we conclude that the court erred in refusing to suppress the statements that defendant made to investigators during his videotaped interrogation after requesting an attorney, and the statements that defendant made on the videotape after the investigators left the interview room." Next is People v. Birch on pages 28 and 29, a street stop case. Second Department held, 1, defendant's waiver of appeal was invalid because the nature and consequences of the waiver were either not explained or were wrongly explained, and 2, the police officer, his name was Connigan, the police officer's initial communication with defendant when the officer was sitting in a moving police vehicle was not a level 1 DeBoer inquiry. Therefore, the switchblade defendant threw away upon the officer's communication was properly admitted in evidence. The court said, "We agree with the Supreme Court's determination that the comment, 'Fellas, how you doing tonight?' constituted a greeting and not a level 1 DeBoer inquiry. Connigan testified at the suppression hearing that when he asked the defendant and the two other males how they were doing, the window to the vehicle was already rolled down and his partner did not stop the vehicle. He also testified that he often greeted people on the street in this way. The credibility determinations of a court following a suppression hearing are entitled to great deference on appeal and will not be disturbed unless clearly unsupported by the record. A view of the record supports the court's finding that Connigan's testimony was credible." Since there was no impermissible request for information by Connigan, the defendant's unprovoked and wholly voluntary act of throwing the switchblade was not in direct and immediate response to any illegal actions by the police. The recovery of the switchblade was not tainted by any illegality because no illegal inquiry occurred. Next is People v. Washington on pages 29 and 30, another street stop case. First Department held the warrantless search of a bag, which was next to the defendant, was not justified as a search of the grabbable area because defendant was handcuffed at the time. The court said, we find that the trial court should have suppressed the 12-inch knife recovered by the police during a warrantless search of defendant's bag. Although at the time of the search the bag was on the floor within the grabbable area next to defendant, he was standing with his arms handcuffed behind his back. These circumstances do not support a reasonable belief that the defendant could have either gained possession of a weapon or destroyed evidence located in the bag. Police did not show any exigency to justify the warrantless search of the bag. Next is People v. Brown on pages 30 and 31, another street stop case. First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Manzanet Daniels, reversing defendant's conviction, held the police illegally seized and frisked the defendant when they had only a level 2 right to inquire. The police were given an anonymous tip that a black man in a bodega wearing a black coat with a fur hood had a gun. The defendant matched the description, but he was seized and frisked in the absence of any sign of criminal activity. The fact that an anonymous tip tended to identify a specific person was not enough to justify the seizure. The handgun should have been suppressed. The court said, the police may not stop and frisk a person based solely on information furnished by an anonymous source that the person is carrying a gun. Since an anonymous tip seldom demonstrates the informant's basis of knowledge or veracity, it can only give rise to reasonable suspicion if accompanied by sufficient indicia of reliability. The tip must be reliable in its assertion of illegality, not just in its tendency to identify a determinate person. Next, People v. Floyd on page 31, another street stop case. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the anonymous tip that persons were acting suspicious going in and out of a U-Haul truck and that one of the persons was wearing a brown hoodie did not justify pulling over a U-Haul truck driven by a man wearing a brown hoodie. The weapon found in the truck after the traffic stop should have been suppressed. The court said the characteristics described in the anonymous tip were readily observable, and the behavior of the individuals described in the tip was consistent with the ordinary use of a U-Haul truck, as the tipster failed to identify what made the behavior suspicious for burglary. Additionally, the tip lacked predictive information and was uncorroborated by the officers, as the U-Haul truck was not at the reported location when the officers arrived. The information that the police received from the anonymous informant, even coupled with the officers' own observations, did not provide them with reasonable suspicion to make an investigatory stop. The next case is on page 32, People v. Suttles, another street stop case. Fourth Department reversed defendant's conviction, suppressing the tangible evidence, held that the police effectively seized defendant by blocking in defendant's vehicle with two police cars without sufficient cause. The court said, we agree with defendant that the police lacked reasonable suspicion to justify the initial seizure of the vehicle, and Supreme Court erred in refusing to suppress both the tangible property seized, which was the weapon, and statements defendant made to the police at the time of his arrest. Police officers effectively seized the vehicle in which defendant was riding when their two patrol cars entered the parking lot in such a manner as to prevent the vehicle from being driven away. The police had at most a founded suspicion that criminal activity was afoot, which permitted them to approach the vehicle and make a common law inquiry of its occupants. They did not, however, have reasonable suspicion that a particular individual was involved in a felony or misdemeanor to justify the seizure that occurred here, and thus the weapon and defendant's statements should have been suppressed. Next is the Edwards case. On page 33, it has to do with the sufficiency of a Superior Court information. Third Department, reversing County Court, held that the Superior Court information to which defendant pled guilty was invalid because it didn't include the approximate time of the offense, and his guilty plea was vacated. In a similar case, People versus Titus, on page 33 and 34, Third Department, reversing county court, held that defendant's guilty plea must be vacated because the waiver of indictment and superior court information were defective. The time of the offense was not indicated. And the final case, it has to do with what someone adjudicated as a youthful offender can divulge or can refuse to divulge and what they must divulge. This was a case in which the defendant had been adjudicated a youthful offender and was involved in a fight with the plaintiff, and the plaintiff was suing the youthful offender. Second Department held that defendant's youthful offender adjudication allows defendant to refuse to answer questions about the charges, the police investigation, whether she pled guilty, and whether a youthful offender adjudication was made, but the defendant cannot refuse to answer questions about the facts underlying the adjudication. Here, plaintiff sued defendant for personal injuries stemming from a fight with the defendant, which was the basis for the youthful offender adjudication. That is the ARMA versus East Islip Union Free School District case on page 34. So that completes this CLE course, which is based on the criminal law decisions released by our New York State appellate courts in April of 2019.